Okay, it is July 7th, 2026. I believe this is the Dalai Lama's birthday, so we could celebrate that along with the other birthdays people mentioned here. I don't know how old he is, but oh, Charmaine is letting us know what?
He's 91.
91. Thank you, Charmaine. Excellent. 91. Well, I haven't made it there yet, so I'll have to let him know, let him tell us what that's like. I did talk to my 88-year-old brother yesterday who said he doesn't feel old, and I told him he was old, so he should really, and he can't understand why all his friends keep dying. And I'm like, dude, you gotta practice Buddhism, man. You don't understand. Everything is impermanent. It's very strange. I can't understand why all my friends are dying. Okay. So we'll begin with a 20-minute sit, and I will guide, get that started with some guidance, and then I'll silence myself. So just settling into your meditation posture, whatever is supportive of your awareness of your bright mind. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. Certainly there's no need to look at the screen. And bringing the attention into the body, letting the body soften. Just however that works for you, how do you intentionally relax your body while maintaining a meditative posture? Oh, this relaxing of the body is joined by a relaxing of the mind, sense of letting go, just being here, nothing to achieve or figure out, nothing to plan. Letting the mind, the attention gather around the breath. And we can pay attention to the breath at the nostrils, that touch of air coming in and out. Or the movement of the belly, the chest, expanding and contracting. In this intentional focus of the mind, we're not trying to stop anything. In fact, what becomes quite apparent is that everything we experience is in motion. The breath, the mind, sensations in the body, energies, sounds. Now, there can be this mistaken notion that we're going to freeze everything with our meditation. Stop the mind. Rather, we can have more of a sense of a flow. The breath is flowing, the mind is flowing, awareness is flowing. And we just follow along with that. The feeling of ease, no rush, grasping. The Zen tradition refers to practice of just sitting. This captures the experience quite well. And we see how different this is from our ordinary behavior. Our minds tend to be busy, planning, calculating, recalling, analyzing, worrying. Our bodies tend to be restless, moving, trying to find comfort. And so just sitting, quite simple, but not easy, really not natural till we train ourselves. We don't have to complicate our practice. Find a primary object of attention, whether it's the breath or the whole body, sounds. And then when you notice the mind has wandered, just gently come back. There may be some underlying tension or struggle. See if you can let that go. Just stay with the simplicity of the practice. Not striving, not trying to control. If there's a lot of agitation, then that becomes the object of attention, turning toward that, breathing with that, allowing that. Non-resistance. Okay. Well, welcome again. And text here that I would draw from. I've been doing a little sort of work. Always interesting. I know some of you have read some suttas, certainly have heard about some, and it's always interesting how we kind of condense them, and I do it, I condense them in my mind. And then when I go back and really go through the details of the language, there's often little details that I sort of hadn't noticed, or some of them can be insignificant, seemingly. But sometimes there's, if you're really sort of asking yourself, is there something here? What does this mean? We can get some things out of it. So the sutta I'm looking at is called the Dart. And it's funny, I just was like, I thought it was called darts. So there we go. And the Buddha has this, at least the way it's translated, has this really odd language. So it starts out by saying, the Buddha saying to the monks, who he calls bhikkhus, because the uninstructed worldling feels a pleasant feeling, a painful feeling, and a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. So this phrase, uninstructed worldling, it's like such an odd little turn of phrase. And Bhikkhu Bodhi will sort of explain terms like this sometimes in the footnotes. There he doesn't have one here, but it's referring to some level of awareness of enlightenment, and I'm not really sure what level it refers to, like whether that means that you're just not like aware that there is something to be learned here, or whether you haven't attained some specific thing. And then the way the Buddha approaches this sutta, he does this thing that he often does where he asks the monks a question. He says, he says, the uninstructed worldling feels pleasant feeling, painful feeling, and what we call, say, neutral, neither painful nor pleasant. But then he says, the instructed noble disciple too feels a pleasant feeling, painful feeling, and neither painful nor pleasant feeling. So the setup of the sutta is that everybody, no matter how enlightened they are, experiences pleasant things and unpleasant things. So that's an important point, because we can get this idea that, oh, once you're enlightened, then you're just happy and everything is great. And the Buddha's saying, no, actually, like, I experience pain, but the point is I respond to it differently. But in any case, so he has this question he asks the monks. Therein, because what is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between the instructed noble disciple and the uninstructed worldling? And then, as the monks virtually always do, when he asks a question like this, he says, they say, our teacher's teachings are rooted in the Blessed One. It would be good if the Blessed One would clear up the meaning. So you're asking us, like, you're the one who knows everything. Like, just tell us. Don't ask, because, and they don't want to embarrass themselves by coming up with some stupid answer. So then he goes on, okay, fine. Then he says, then listen and attend closely. Because when the uninstructed worldling is being contacted by a painful feeling, he sorrows, grieves, and laments. He, she, they weep, beating their breast, and they become distraught. They feel two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. So here's the essence of this sutta. He feels, they feel two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. The language of it, I love the way he kind of, they weep beating their breasts, they sorrow, grieve, and lament. So, but what I kind of want to bring out here, because I think many of you are probably familiar with this teaching, is that in this sutta, the Buddha never refers to, he doesn't refer to mental pain and our reaction to mental pain. He refers only to physical pain and our mental reaction to that. And that's important. I mean, it's really, really important. But my practice, my life, is much more concerned with mental pain. Obviously, there are plenty of times when there's physical pain, but it's the mental pain that, kind of defines the quality of my life, and that kind of has triggered unwholesome behavior, addictive behavior, has triggered depressive experiences. But he doesn't address that. And I think that my sense is that most of us kind of assume that that's part of what he's saying. And I don't think he's, well, he's not saying that, I will say. He's not talking about, like, getting in a bad mood and then sorrow, grieving and beating your breast. In other words, like, oh, I'm in a bad mood. Oh, what's wrong with me? I'm so miserable and my life sucks and I'm such a jerk, or all the kind of story, right? We have a painful emotion and then we have this big story that comes out of it. He's not talking about that, and I don't know of anywhere in the suttas where he is. And yet, we, Western Buddhism, I would really argue, is almost founded in the idea that this is implicit in the Buddha's teachings. And you could make that argument that it's implicit, but it certainly is not explicit, not in this sutta. So let me talk, go into a few of the other things that are in this sutta. So in any case, the name of the sutta, the dart, comes out of the simile that the Buddha then uses, right? Again, I think many of you are familiar with this. This person who has had this painful physical feeling and a mental feeling, he says, it's supposed they were to strike a man, a person, with a dart, and then they would strike them immediately afterwards with a second dart. So that person would feel a feeling caused by two darts. So too, when the uninstructed worldling is contacted by a painful feeling, he feels two bo feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. So the darts represent, the physical feeling and the mental feeling. And the second dart, which is again like a term that we use a lot in Buddhism, the second dart is that reaction. So then he goes on then to say a lot about that. And I think this is worth examining a little bit. Being contacted by the painful feeling, one harbors aversion toward it. So Now he's being more specific about what happens. You have this pain, and then you have aversion. It's that second dart is aversion. Okay, that's what he's being, bringing clarity to what he's really saying. And now he gets even like more, although he gets into the details. When one harbors aversion toward painful feeling, the underlying tendency to aversion toward painful feeling lies behind this. So it's not just that you have aversion to pain, but that there you have a whole tendency, you have a whole, what I would call instinctive response to pain, which is aversion. So this is why enlightenment is really hard to attain, because there's this instinctive reaction to pain. And to not react with aversion to pain requires a tremendous, I'll say, equanimity. So, and then he says, being contacted by painful feeling, one seeks delight in sensual pleasure. And now we get down to how addiction arises. Okay. So this really takes us through the process of addiction. There's a painful feeling, you have aversion to it. There's this underlying tendency to aversion. But you don't just have aversion. You go, oh, how can I want to feel good. So I'm in pain. I have aversion. I know what I can do. Roll a joint, pour a drink, lay out a line, go to the refrigerator, get that pint of ice cream, whatever it is, let me get to the casino, whatever your addiction is, right? Let me go shopping. And okay, so those are like addictive habits, but we also know that even in recovery, even with a fair amount of awareness, we'll still do something. I think I'll just take a walk right now because it'll be more pleasant. And that's not bad. It's not that, every reaction is unwholesome, but just as it's nonetheless good to see, like, oh, what am I doing? And I would, how am I reacting? How am I trying to fix my experience? And I would say, it's not that we should cease all efforts to feel good. That's not the teaching. But I do think it's wise to take a moment to feel the discomfort and to breathe with that and just see, oh, what does this feel like? And can I just be with it for a moment and breathe? And now I'm going to make a right effort, right? I'm going to do something wholesome to step out of this. I don't have to just, sit down and be miserable and feel pain, but can I take a moment and be with it and see, and confront it directly? Oh, this is this. It's what this feels like. Okay, I see that. But I do think this is really illuminating. Even though, I mean, in some ways, it's not like you read this and you go, really? That's what happens? That's shocking. No, I mean, it makes perfect sense to us as addicts, and I think probably would make sense to even to non-addicts, but particularly to see this as the process of addiction. It's not that it's a revelation, but it is helpful to not just kind of like, rush over things, blur over things, but to, take things apart, see, oh, yeah, I see how that works. So the Buddha goes on here, and it's quite, this guy doesn't, no stone unturned. So being contacted by painful feeling, one seeks delight in sensual pleasure. For what reason? Well, we would just say, well, because we don't like it. No, because the uninstructed worldling does not know of any escape from painful feeling other than sensual pleasure. Well, that's kind of interesting, right? So what he's saying is there is an escape from this. You can get out of pain. But you think the only way to do it is by doing something that feels good. When one seeks delight in sensual pleasure, the underlying tendency to lust for pleasant feeling lies behind this. So we've got now a second underlying tendency, right? When there's pain, I have this underlying tendency to aversion. When there's wanting pleasure, it's the underlying tendency, what he calls lust or craving, desire. So we can see we're building now to the three poisons, desire, greed, hatred, and delusion is the typical framing. One does not understand as it really is the origin and passing away, the gratification, the danger, and the escape in the case of these feelings. When one does not understand these feelings, the underlying tendency to ignorance in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling lies behind this. So he doesn't exactly tell, say, explain how one escapes from this cycle. But well, let's look at that. There's just a little bit more in the sutta, so as long as we're going through it. Okay. So he's saying here that in this paragraph that he's talking about greed, hatred, and delusion, or desire, aversion, and ignorance. Here he's framing them, if they're translated as lust, as aversion, lust, and ignorance. And that these are these underlying tendencies, right? So that's, again, a very familiar Buddhist teaching. And we can clearly see how it connects into addictive behavior. So he goes on, if one feels a pleasant feeling, one feels it attached. If one feels a painful feeling, one feels it attached. If one feels a neutral feeling, one feels it attached. This bhikkhu is called an uninstructed worldling who is attached to birth, aging, and death, who is attached to sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair, who is attached to suffering. And this is a really odd framing, right? It makes it sound like we want these things. We're attached to greed, hatred, and delusion. But it's really this process that we're attached to, that we're attached to, fixing the unpleasant feelings. We're attached to having the pleasant feelings. And it's because we can't disengage from these underlying tendencies, we keep going through this process of birth, aging, and death, right? Sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. We are attached to suffering, he says. Such a, again, very odd framing, right? We don't think of it that way. But ultimately, what he's saying is that if you really understand how things work, you won't follow this reactive pattern. You will interrupt it and you will let go. You'll stop acting out of aversion. You'll stop seeking delight in sensual pleasure. You'll stop fighting with or being averse to pain. And you'll see all these habit patterns, and you'll let them go. So the last paragraph is about what the instructed worldling does. The instructed noble disciple, sorry. So this is somebody who has some degree of enlightenment. When the instructed noble disciple is contacted by a painful feeling, they do not sorrow, grieve, or lament. They do not weep, beating their breast, and become distraught. They feel one feeling, a bodily one, not a mental one. Suppose they were to strike a person with a dart, they would not strike them immediately afterward with a second dart, so that the person would feel a feeling caused by one dart only. So too, when the instructed noble disciple is contacted by a painful feeling, they feel one feeling, a bodily one, not a mental one. So let's just take that into if they are contacted by a painful mental feeling, they feel a painful mental feeling, and they don't build a story out of that, and they don't try to seek delight in sensual pleasure. They don't have aversion to it. They just experience it, and they see that it's happening. They see, and so the underlying tendencies cause these that I was calling instinctive, when they're not seen, just cause an automatic series of responses: aversion to pain, seeking delight, seeking escape. So this is in the larger teaching, the more detailed teaching, what's called dependent origination, that there's this whole process that happens that starts with our not being aware. In dependent origination, it's called ignorance, but that just means the lack of awareness, which includes the lack of understanding, so right view. So if we really see how things work, we don't go into this cycle. So again, coming back to the framing of addiction, which is such a, to me, effective way of bringing out what the Buddha is talking about. When you come into recovery, you've gotten this awareness of this process. You understand that when you react to the craving, or just the aversion to the feeling you're having, and you seek delight, you know where that leads. You understand that it leads to sorrow, lamentation, displeasure, and despair, that it leads to suffering. And so you have this whole picture, and you don't have to keep painting it every time, right? It's already done. It's like, I know where that goes. And so I have this moment of experience, typically unpleasant, but it can be pleasant too. It can be like the smell of marijuana on the street, or the look of a shimmering glass of champagne, that's like, but you're not deluded by it. You don't have ignorance. You understand gratification, danger, and escape. You understand that, yeah, one drink would be pleasant, but that it's where it's going to lead, the danger it's going to lead to. And so your escape is you don't start. You don't, if, okay, another version of this. If the trap is a room, and if you walk into that room, it's the room of addiction, you just don't walk in. That's the escape. There's no, you don't have to get run out. You don't go in the first place. So it's, the challenging thing about the Buddha's teaching is that this process that we understand around addiction, he says it actually applies to every moment of our lives, that because of these underlying tendencies, that we are constantly falling into these little traps. We're constantly getting struck by second darts. And, I listen to enough teachings from monastics to know that just because people are in robes, that they don't escape from this They fall it, just because they've given up, sex and drugs and literally rock and roll, and various other things, indulgences, they still fall into these habit patterns, these underlying tendencies. So we don't need to compare ourselves and be like, well, I mean, I can only do so much. I'm not a, enlightened, or I'm not a monastic. No, I think it's just an invitation, which I think is a much better way of framing it, right, than a rule. But that these teachings are an invitation to investigate the many ways that we fall into aversion and escaping and seeking delight. And again, really not to suggest we should all live in some, gray space where we don't have any pleasure. I was just reading something from Bhikkhu Bodhi, I'm sorry, Ajahn Pasano, where he there's a line from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is the sutta about the end of the Buddha's life, where he's leaving a town, Vesali, I think, and he gets to a rise and he turns around and he looks at it and he says, "It's really a beautiful city, and this is the last time I'm going to see it." And then he turns around and walks away. And Ajahn Pasano says, "So what we can see from that is the Buddha enjoys this visual experience. He's able to say, that's beautiful. I love seeing that. And I'm okay with letting it go." So that's I think the challenge, and we run into this so much in the Buddhist teachings. You get like, oh, I'm not supposed to enjoy anything. Oh, that's dangerous. No, and we try to turn it into black and white teachings, but it's much more challenging than that because the Buddha's saying, no, you can enjoy it. Just watch when you get attached. Watch when you're clinging. See, can you enjoy it and let it go? Enjoy it and let it go. Can you respond to pain by a wholesome action that will relieve the pain and bring a pleasant experience without getting attached and without acting reactively? So it's not a not acting out of the underlying tendency of aversion, but rather out of a wise response that, oh, this is, I'm having pain, then it's a wise thing to do to take a Tylenol, for instance. So it's funny, I always get so much when I go through, like going through the sutta again, I'm like, oh, there's so much here I need to investigate. So I hope it was helpful for you and I appreciate your attention. And I will see if there's any comments or questions. Thanks, Monica, for putting in the links to the sutta. Well, I guess there, what else is there to say? I mean,
Kevin, it's great talk. I have to leave right at the top of the hour, so I'll just leave the computer running if you're still,
Okay.
and it'll just turn off when you're done.
Okay. Thank you. Well, if there aren't any comments, questions, thoughts. Someone entered the I could continue to talk, but I can't think of anything to say.
I have a sort of a comment question. Can you hear me?
Okay, yes.
It strikes me that how you view pleasure, if you're aware of how you're using it, is the key here too. You can seek pleasure, but not as a reaction to it. So it puts a little bit of a slant on what you're talking about, I think. So I guess that's my comment. Thank
Yeah,
you.
no, I think that clarifies. That's right. You know what am I doing right now? And I mean, I'd say there's two sides, but one is, what's my motivation? Am I doing this with, a kind of wholesome intent, like taking a walk in the woods? Like, that's going to be pleasant, but it's a wholesome intent. But there's also the noticing how much is reactive internally. And that's the seeing the aversion and the unwillingness to be with the discomfort or the not even unwillingness. There's no reason we have to hang out with discomfort that's not, necessary, but yeah, just that's reactive. That's like lacking awareness. And I mean, that's kind of what is called for in this, as it is in all teachings. Like, can I bring awareness to what's going on? And then I can watch it and learn. And sometimes I'll make a decision and then I'll see later on, well, that wasn't the best decision, or, oh, that was a wise decision. And then, that's co clear comprehension, this idea that we kind of watch how we things play out, and we try to learn from our mistakes, learn from our successes, and kind of, improve for future performance, I guess the other thing, actually, thank you, Monica. I had forgot to mention that this Friday night is my Dharma and Recovery group at Spirit Rock online, 6 o'clock Pacific time. So if you are interested, I will be talking this week about right speech. I've been going through the Eightfold Path, so I'm just was trying to remember where I was. Yeah, so always a good topic. So I appreciate people showing up and your support as always. And be back next Tuesday. And as I said, next Tuesday night I'll be at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery in the evening at 7:30 for anybody in the Bay. In a couple weeks, I'm going to be in New Jersey at the Noble Steps group. That's on a Sunday night, 2 weeks from this past Sunday. So that would be the 19th, I guess. I'm also going to be at a conference at the Metta Monastery in New Jersey on the 18th, on some kind of a panel. Anybody who's in the New York, New Jersey area. Should be a w lovely conference. It's mostly monastics. Somehow got in on some kind of a pass, but Bhikkhu Bodhi is supposed to be there. So I'm excited to see him and the other monastics. So thank you all for your, as I said, for your attention and for being here and your support. And hope to see you at one of these Zoom or in-person events. So take care. Thank you.